The views expressed on Blunt are not those of the University of Southern Maine or WMPG. The University of Southern Maine is WMPG is on the air thanks to listener donations and generous support from the University of Southern Maine. USM educates Maine's future artists, business people, engineers, healthcare professionals, lawyers, managers, public servants, scientists, and teachers. More information is available at usm.maine.edu.
Start sometime. What better place than here? What better time than now?
What's your contribution going to be? What problems are you going to solve? What discoveries will you make?
I intend to broadcast from this ship 24 hours a day until the day I die. And then for a couple days after that.
No one's written your destiny for you. You make your own future.
I've always lived for news and weather. Happy to die for them too, especially the weather.
In the summer of 1967, something strange was taking place in the west and east coasts of the United States. Hundreds of thousands of long-haired, far-out, bead-wearing men and women congregated in cities like San Francisco and New York to celebrate peace, love, and togetherness.
The resulting phenomenon has come to be known as the Summer of Love, and is defined today by gender equality, free love, psychedelic drugs, and not to mention music.
The music of the 1960s defined the generation like none had before. Groups like Jefferson Airplane, The Grateful Dead, and even The Beatles were writing and recording music, the likes of which had never been heard by ears young or old.
Music often reflects what's going on in the world at the time. Protest songs with political overtones dominated the airwaves throughout the 1960s. This trend peaked in 1967 when the group Buffalo Springfield released the iconic For What It's Worth.
We weren't there, but for tonight's show, we brought in a couple of folks who were. Bonnie Blythe and Dave Wade, welcome to the show.
Hey, groovy.
Yeah, thank you for being here. I'd just like to tell our listeners that this is a call-in show, so please share questions or comments. You know, were you there for the Summer of Love? Let us know. The number is 780-4909. Again, that's 780-4909.
So you guys are...
Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Ira San Giovanni, and who are you?
I am Anthony Lewis. So you two are both Portland residents and veterans, if you will, of the Summer of Love. If you could, would you guys tell us kind of how would you define the summer of 1967?
Well, first of all, thank you, Anthony and Iris and Dave, for sharing these moments. Buffalo Springfield, that was a great intro. For me... 1967, I was 15 years old, so I was in between my freshman and sophomore year high school. I was pretty impressionable, and I lived about an hour south of here in Hampton, New Hampshire, and the Hampton Beach Casino at that time had lots of music coming, so we'll talk more about it, but Janis Joplin came, The Doors, you know, lots of great acts. So for me, it was a lot about the music. And then also sort of just kind of a real opening as a young person to a whole huge world of youth and experience and peace and love and all that, which I'm still a fan of peace and love to this day. How about you, Dave?
Beautiful. You know, that song, Buffalo Springfield, could have been written yesterday. It's still every day, it seems right. It was a time that we were involved in the Vietnam War as a young man of draft age, whose number was in the can and coming up. I was under a lot of pressure, as many and most of my peers were, and it was a protest movement against the war, which we saw as an overseas war that had no bearing on America, that it was an illegal war in that regard. And I think it caused the movement to take place. And the music came along, and it sort of gave a beat to things. And it wasn't just about the war. It was about creating an alternative, something positive rather than a negative thing. And so there was this positive vibration that was taking place.
For sure.
And, you know, like, speaking of the Vietnam War, I mean, I took a, United States history class, and there, you know, we discussed the war, the ins and outs, but we might have briefly talked about, like, the other movements that were going on, and I was, like, because I was trying to think, you know, like, the Summer of Love, it's, you know, so well known, but I seemed to not know much about it, and I guess just the lack of discussion in, that class, how does that make you feel?
I don't think I've really thought about it. How about you, Dave? But since this show came on my plate, I've wondered how if younger people are aware at all of that whole time, or what you think, or if you knew about, especially a moment in time like 1967, in the Summer of Love. So I guess I'm curious to know that from you two.
Yeah, I think it's kind of great that you're doing this, because it gives it context.
Yeah, I mean, I know for myself, like, I mean, I kind of just, like, can generalize it, like, oh, I know, well, the 70s, the 60s, the 80s, but, talking specifically about the Summer of Love, I don't know that much about it. And I know I hadn't actually heard of the term before.
Wow.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, it's this show has been going to be a great opportunity to learn more about it. But, speaking from your experiences, do you think it should have a place in history? And,
I think it's part of sort of a wave. Dave and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, that really began in the early 60s, as you said, Iris, with the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. and different awareness coming into. I mean, in the 50s, we came from a very different world. It was very, I don't know if you've seen the old reruns, but Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie and Harriet, it was a really different world. So
very conformist,
yeah.
very bland.
Women stayed home, raised the kids.
The roles, yeah, were all
very
dictated.
Defined. Then the civil rights movement came along. Martin Luther King's speech, "I Have a Dream," was in 1964. The free speech movement, mm-hmm. where someone declared, "Don't ever trust anyone over 30."
Well, that was Abby Hoffman a little bit later, but that free speech, yeah. Was it Berkeley?
Yeah, so
beginning of campus unrest that really took off in first at Berkeley, and then later spread across in 68. There was a whole university kind of thing.
Right. But so those things did lead up to this 1967 era, where Dave, I understand, was actually in Haight-Ashbury. And I wonder if you guys know about Haight-Ashbury?
Well, do you guys want to tell us a little bit about it, maybe what's going on there?
And your story.
Well, it was a music thing, and there was a movement, I suppose, that I didn't plan on being part of it. I thought it was, there was a song called "If You're Going to San Francisco, Be Sure to Wear Some Flowers in Your Hair." And to me, it was really hokey, and I had no intention of going to San Francisco. I thought we were being manipulated, and I decided there was other stuff going on, like Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth Catalog, a Back to Earth movement, and just the sort of rejection of these conformist middle-class existence that we had been part of. And I hit the road and was camping out and stopped in San Francisco to do some laundry. And
yeah, I've got the song playing for
happened.
You here. Yeah? So you got to San Francisco, and did you plan on staying long? Or I mean, were you... I know you said that the song kind of almost made you not want to go to San Francisco, but once you got there, did your opinion change? I mean, did you think maybe this place isn't too bad?
Well, it was an eyeful. It was a trip. I mean, it was a real trip. I went to the laundromat to do my laundry, and the next thing I knew, I was at the Fillmore, tripped out, listening to Cream, and I didn't leave. Things happen.
Yeah.
You know? It was a happening.
Yeah. And meanwhile, back on the East Coast, like close to Portland, not that far away, as I said, Janis Joplin came, the Doors came, and it was, again, that kind of that vibe that sort of emanated across the land. Kids hitchhiking everywhere, which we're not promoting hitchhiking, but in those days, there were, you know, it was a way of life for many people.
It was contagious. I mean, it was something in the air. It was love was in the air. I mean, love was part of it, and it's hard not to buy into that. And there was this idea of freedom and sharing, and it was a rejection of what went before, and much more and less competitive and more of a communal cooperative existence that was very appealing. Mm-hmm. And you wanted to be part of it, and so you fell in.
Yeah, I'm just like curious as to how this spread, because I mean, looking back, you know where we are in our lives right now, like social media, like, you know, Facebook and just, you know, like just the use of the internet is one way that we really connect and spread information. But, you know, how did this movement that was so huge, how did this spread from, you know, West Coast to East Coast?
I think that's a great question, because I thought about that too. I mean, there's certainly no internet, but I think one huge unifying thing was music was huge, and just, we did see on television images of the Vietnam War and Martin Luther King, so we were aware of the civil rights things going on. But in terms of the youth movement, I don't know. It just sort of exploded, and people. There were lots of freaks, as we call freaks, and
we'd be freaks.
We had unifying like signs, like the peace sign. Really was, mm-hmm. You kind of knew long hair. Dress, the way that people dress, so you sort of saw each other and knew that you were kind of in the same place.
Yeah, there was like a stylistic declaration, long hair, beads, bell bottoms, tie-dyed, you know, it was a whole rejection of the earlier styles, and along with it came a music that was rejecting the musical styles and a graphics, even a press that was rejecting it. And I think one of the most exciting things to come out of it was the art coming out of the poster art coming out of the rock places, and the new magazines, alternative press that was hitting the street, that was not your staid old newspapers. These were not Hearst or type papers. These were real people's paper. The Avatar, the Berkeley Barb.
Well, what are a couple of examples of this kind of art? Like, what do you guys remember most, be it poster art or anything else? Like, what are some examples that you guys can recall? You know,
the Fillmore had great posters. Fillmore, and then there was Fillmore East in New York. So there was Fillmore in San Francisco.
The Avalon Ballroom.
The Avalon.
Family Dog. They had Rick Griffin and Mouse Kelly were two of the big artists, all that psychedelic type that it got to a point. And it got to a point where you had difficulty reading anything.
Yeah.
It was a trip. I mean, it was entertaining, but what does it say? You know?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
We'd like to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show. If you have any questions or comments, if you were there during the Summer of Love, you know someone who was, be sure to call us at 780-4909. That's 780-4909.
And, like, just talking about, like, the peace sign and just sort of, like, other, things associated with, this, like, hippie culture in the movement. What are your thoughts on, like, nowadays when there are, you know, shirts and other, you know, merchandise that is being sold and sort of, you know, turning that movement into something, like, materialistic?
Yeah, I've thought about that, too, because we tie-dyed our own shirts, you know, and now they're manufactured.
There was a commercial aspect that it always at work. I mean, I really think that, in a way, somebody with a vision saw a new way, a new market to develop, and they worked us. I mean, when we were willing, we were happy guinea pigs, you know. It was a trip. It was fun. And, you know, I mean, we had our own language. Everything was groovy and far out. And,
yeah.
And, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was very far out.
Speaking of the sort of the recreation of those tie-dye shirts and what people choose to remember from that time, do you think that any of that has been romanticized as the years have gone by and the decades have gone by, or do you think people have kind of, you know, people today have captured the way that it really was back then? I mean, do you see any disparity there?
I don't know. I think I might subscribe to the notion that if you remember the 60s, you weren't there.
Yeah.
It was not intentional. It was spontaneous. And so anything that's a recreation is what it is. It's a recreation and can be seen as that. You know, I mean, look at sports teams. Look at the proliferation of sports teams memorabilia. Everybody's walking around with a number and a name on their back. They have nothing to do with it. Those are professional guys making millions of dollars.
But, yeah, sure.
You know, you buy into it.
On the other hand, I think, you know, it was definitely a subculture, a counterculture, and I think that's true today, too. I mean, I see kids who sort of look like they identify as hippies, whether or not their clothes are manufactured. I see them, and I think that they probably ascribe to that, those kinds of notions of sort of freedom and
equality. That's right, yeah. I mean, you can buy into it, but there was, you know, you can adopt it. I mean, just as much as, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, we're going to take this time. We have a caller. We have Ed from Portland. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I remember I was upstate in little podunk town, Fairfield. We used to have to go to Waterville to get the Rolling Stone, which back then was a biweekly, and I'm not sure how often it's published now. It might be just a monthly. But it was very instrumental in getting news out to those in lesser populated areas. And I remember going down to the head shop, which is, you know, the only place that you could get it back, and finding out what was going on, you know, on the West Coast or around the world, what was going on in England music-wise and such. And, it was a memorable time. Memorable time. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Ed. Where was the head shop that you went to from Fairfield, Ed?
The one in Waterville, it was on Silver Street. I can picture it, but I can't remember the name of it.
But you had to travel, you know, a fair distance to get to the shop, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
and
like,
the one in Portland, once I get down to Portland, Erebus. On Center Street? Free Street. Center Street.
So, yeah. It sounds like you kind of had to, in order to sort of get this kind of news and information, you know, you kind of had to work for it, and I know, it's just interesting for me.
It's different today.
Yeah, nowadays it's just...
Do you think that the energy today is more diffuse in a way? It doesn't build to, like, a head? Like, there was a movement and things were building to a head, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And we were just, like, caught up in it, really. Mm-hmm. I wasn't intentional, personally.
Well, we want to thank Ed from Portland for calling in. It's great to hear from you, Ed, and hopefully we'll hear from you again sometime.
And if you want to be like Ed, the number is 780-4909. Again, that's 780-4909, so call in. But, Dave, to, you know, talk about what you were saying, like, I guess for me, I feel it's almost in a way because there's so much available, it's almost like you're bombarded with all of these issues and all of these, you know, so, like, it's oftentimes, like, it's just, like, your mind is conflicted with all these things to think about and to, you know, in order to get involved with. But, yeah, like, I do, yeah, it is interesting because it doesn't seem, I mean, like, what are we building up to? And
yeah.
I mean, speaking of sort of like the connection between those days and today, we were wondering if you thought something like the Summer of Love could happen again in the modern times with today's young people. You know, I mean, can you see that happening again, or do you think that was a strictly 1960s mentality?
I think something could happen again. I don't think the same thing, and it wouldn't have the same paraphernalia probably, but it might. You know, I mean, it was youth movement, and youth are powerful, you know, a powerful body that can do things and change history, and that's what it was about. You know, we can change history, and we will. And we went out in the street and made a scene.
Yeah, right on.
I just want to take this time to, you know, we're talking about the Summer of Love, 1967. I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
I am Anthony Lewis.
And in studio with us, we have Bonnie Blythe and Dave Wade, who are both, you know, around at the time when this, you know, movement happened.
Yeah. So I guess what, you know, above all else stands out to you guys from the summer of 1967? Is it, you know, was it the music? Was it a certain part of the culture? Was it, you know, just what do you remember the most from? So I know you said that if you remember the 60s, you weren't there, but if you could, you know, you know, call upon some memory, what stood out to you the most?
I think, like Dave said, it was just a feeling. And I don't know if it was like a feeling of belonging to a tribe. It was kind of like a
It was the sharing.
Tribe.
Yeah. It was sharing. Yeah. That was the odd thing. You know, we were really sharing with people we didn't know, and it was really quite anonymous, but all of a sudden there was this large fraternity, this large sense of brotherhood, what have you.
And
sisterhood. It wasn't politically correct, mind you, but there was that, and sort of a more of a tribal rather than a, well, I don't know how to say that. But
the music really also
propelled
was it. Huge.
Yeah.
For me, and just, I don't know, the values that came out of it, which I've carried with me, I think.
What sorts of values are those, do you think? I mean,
just a sense of that we all have a responsibility to one another and to this planet that we live on, and trying to promote goodwill towards others.
I think the flower power idea was, you know, obviously it was a pithy little slogan or something, but there was a sense of creating a loving environment. So it was to make beauty, to create beauty, make your life, make others' lives beautiful.
Right. That's huge.
That's huge.
Creativity.
Now, you mentioned sort of showing love for not only for one another, but for the earth. Was the message of environmentalism, I mean, would people look back today on the hippie movement and they think that it was really very connected with environmentalism and preserving the earth? Was that something that you consciously thought about at the time, or is that something that sort of just came out of the peace and love that you were already feeling?
I think it kind of came out of all that. I know Earth Day began, that might have been a couple years later.
70.
Yeah, so that sort of grew out of that. And then just the whole environmental movement kind of grew from that as well as a lot of other movements like the women's movement and the kind of rebelling against the macho hippie males.
There's certainly the same problems in the society.
Yeah.
But it was something else. I mean, I was like into the woods and camping a lot, and to me, those values of you know that and the identification with the Native American, or at least the Aboriginal American, and their connection to this wealth of flora and fauna, and you know, being on the ground and digging into it, and being a caretaker rather than an excavator and a manipulator. There was that sense of it, and there was people forget about Stuart Brand and
the Whole Earth Catalog,
which put together an idea that didn't really exist before. He may have been the one who used ecology first. I don't know.
Yes.
Could you guys do us a favor and kind of tell us what the Whole Earth Catalog was? I think I certainly don't know what that was.
It was the coolest book I ever saw.
Big, oversized newsprint.
Big oversized newsprint and
magazine,
and it was a book. I mean, it was like a catalog. It was like a coffee table size, but on cheap paper. But it had all these listings of different reference materials around the world about different types of organic this and that, and type, and music, and food, and mechanics, and space travel, and everything. It was like a cross denominational, cross discipline. It was just like a trip to sit down, and I mean, you could waste the whole day, you know, and learn something with this. And so it was really, it was what today is like going on to Google and just throwing a word out there and seeing what, and then looking at all the offerings you have. It was sort of like that. It was just like this real mishmash of variety of stuff, and you didn't know any of these things, and they were very, very interesting.
And kind of a movement grew out of that related to environmental stuff, which was organic gardening and farming and people homesteading and going out to the country and living off the earth. And even here in Maine, Helen and Scott Nearing, all who lived up the coast and had a farm that people could come and learn from. So,
And, you know, they told you how to make composters and stuff. And this was a time when people were building domes. Remember the dome people?
Yurts and domes.
Yurts and domes and different kinds of habitants.
Tree houses.
Tree houses. I lived in a tree house.
Now, there was a lot of music sort of surrounding like the psychedelic movement. There were bands like Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane with songs like White Rabbit. They, you know, they came out in 1967. And now this music was, you know, it was brilliant and iconic and it defined a generation. But do you think there were problems with the excessive psychedelic drug use? Do you think that caused more problems than it, you know, than it solved? Or what's your opinion on that?
I can't remember.
Dave can't remember.
Didn't do a lot for your memory.
I think, psychedelic drugs were definitely prevalent even on the East Coast. And as a young teen, I have to admit that I experimented with some of those, and then I had a bad trip, and it was really scary. And I never did that again. And I think my experience with San Francisco, because I did make it there a few years later in 1970, and what I saw when I went to Haight-Ashbury, kind of, you know, as somebody who was like, oh, Haight-Ashbury, was a lot of really burned out people.
Sure. Now, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but before we go to break, we've got a call from Ava and Zoe from Blunt in Portland. Are you guys on the line?
Hey.
Hi. Hello? Yeah, hello.
Hi. Great show so far. I had a question. I was wondering, so I know the Summer of Love happened in San Francisco. I was wondering if there's any prevalence of it other places in the world, and if so, what kinds of things?
Dave would probably know more, but I'm thinking probably like Amsterdam and kind of around the world, don't you think?
Amsterdam comes to mind probably as sort of a free...
Paris, though,
a place. This was a very liberating influence. So, I mean, this was also... The word free was very important, and free love was part of the sexual revolution. But there was free food, and there was free, you know... It was really free,
And it was a worldwide movement, I think, because, you know, I think about Greece and Crete and hippies in the caves and the free love thing, I think, is really important because the birth control pill came into that in 1967.
Couldn't happen
without it. The birth control pill revolutionized women's choices about what they were going to do
behavior
with their
When you say hippies in the caves, what do you mean by that? I think a lot of people my age might not really understand what that means.
And another way I'd say that we got this information, because we didn't have the internet, things like Life magazine.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
So Life magazine was a big, colorful magazine that had a lot of photographs. And so, you know, then you would see the photographs of hippies on the sides of mountains and on the Greek islands.
Yeah, in their buses, you know, painted the flower power buses.
Yeah.
And Yeah, yeah.
So it was through print, a lot of it, and TV.
All right. Well, we want to thank you, Ava and Zoe, for calling in. It's, you know, about 8 o'clock now, so I think, you know.
Think we're gonna go to break.
Yeah, and then we're just gonna keep on talking.
Once again, we're here with Bonnie Blythe and Dave Wade. I'm Anthony Lewis,
and I'm Iris Sangiovanni. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
The tambourine man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Though I know that evening's empire has returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes me, I am branded on my feet. I have no one to meet, and the ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Take me on a trip upon your magic swirling ship. My senses have been stripped. My hands can't feel to grip, my toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. I'm ready to go anywhere, I'm ready for to fade into my own parade. Cast your dance and spill my way, I promise to go under it. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In a jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Though you might hear laughing, spinning, swinging madly across the sun, it's not aimed at anyone, it's just escaping on the run. And but for the sky, there are no fences facing. And if you hear vague traces of skipping reels of rhyme to your tambourine in time, it's just a ragged clown behind. I wouldn't pay it any mind. It's just a shadow you're seeing that he's chasing. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the frozen leaves, the haunted, frightened trees, out to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow.
Yes, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sands, with all memory and fate driven deep beneath the waves. Let me forget about today until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you.
Tonight mostly clear. Why is it not? Tonight mostly clear, humid with lows in the upper 60s. Southwest winds around 10 miles per hour in the evening, becoming light and variable. Tuesday partly sunny, humid with highs in the upper 80s. Light and variable winds. Tuesday night mostly cloudy in the evening, then becoming partly cloudy. Humid with lows in the upper 60s. Light and variable winds.
Welcome back. It's good to have you.
Yeah, welcome back.
So we are talking about the summer of 1967, better known as the Summer of Love. I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
And I am Anthony Lewis.
This is Blunt Youth Radio, and with us in studio we have Bonnie Blythe and Dave Wade, who are in Portland, or Portland residents, and vets of the Sum of Love. And I'd just like to remind you before we begin, this is a call-in show, and the number is 780-4909. The number is 780-4909, so please call. Now on the line we have Nancy Galland, who was at Greenwich Village at the time, and is now become a political activist and environmentalist.
Nancy, are you there?
I'm here. Hi.
Hi, Nancy. We were just kind of wanted to ask you a little bit about what the scene was like in Greenwich Village during the Summer of Love. We've been talking mostly about San Francisco and the West Coast, but can you tell us kind of what was going on in New York at the time?
It was really a very strong, I think, connection to the East Coast and West Coast. We used to joke about the middle of the country not really existing because there was so much going on. We had a Fillmore East, you know, and we had, you know, all kinds of the same kind of cultural things going on. Abby Hoffman was one of our iconic leaders, and he lived there. And, you know, many of us lived in basement apartments or really very, very cheap, what they call cold water flats, where the bathtub would be in the kitchen. These were the same apartments that probably many of our ancestors lived with us in as immigrants. These were the same places that the first waves of immigrants lived in when they came to New York at the turn of the century and the early part of the 20th century. So, and there was this idea of voluntary poverty that we kind of took that mantle on in an effort to, drop out of those materialistic values that we were trying to reject. And also because, as it has been mentioned on the show, there was this very strong feeling of wanting to be equal to our brothers and sisters economically as well as socially. So, were wearing, they were kind of like uniforms. There was like the dungarees and the denim jackets and you know, oversized clothing and big old secondhand fur coats and, you know, all kinds of wild embroidered clothing. And big hat. So it was, you know, I think the scene was very similar.
And Nancy, again, I'm so glad to have you on. And so you're talking about this, you know, voluntary poverty, and it kind of goes along. Dave, you were saying, like, you know, this free love, like free food, like, and just with the whole vibe of this movement. I mean, is it not like it's so you sort of had the money, right? I mean, but just how.
Not exactly.
No, I mean, just like how, I mean, like there was a cost to living, but just how did you know.
Spare change, man.
Sorry. I can't tell you how many times people of my generation will say, it was so much easier for us then than it is for this generation now of people our age, how old we were then. Things were cheaper. There was more access to, housing. I think I paid $30 a month for my place. There wasn't the gentrification hadn't happened yet. So it was just more possible to live, without much money. And there was kind of a, it was part of the culture to live with as little money as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think there are traces of what was laid down back then going on now. The dumpster diving, sexual liberation movement, the attempts at making anarchism work. There's lots of things, including the environmentalism, that are still alive, very much alive, and it seems to have skipped a few generations. But it's there. And it's really wonderful for us old hippies to see it.
I think the Portland's Garbage to Garden project illustrates that, which is where you can put out a bin. You can put your food scraps into a bin, and these young people come along in a truck and pick it up and leave you a bucket of compost. I mean, that's sort of what you're talking about,
brilliant.
Nancy. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's the kind of thing of creating a subculture outside of the mainstream culture and trying to make it work.
And, like, you know, from, you know, throughout this entire, you know, this discussion, like, there seems to be a lot of, like, positive values that you've all taken from the experience, you know, to live, you know, on little means and to, you know, live in as a community. But let's talk about, were there any negative experiences or, you know, any regrets that you have?
Yeah, sure. I mean, everything has a good side and a bad side. It was a time of great mobility, and it's no surprise that California was home to it because sort of California dreaming and that whole idea of mobility and footlooseness and a lot of itinerant people who, you know, put their guitar over their shoulder and hit the road, and they said, I'm going to make the scene, and they showed up, and maybe it worked and maybe it didn't. People got over their heads, let's say, that there was there's a lot of heavy duty stuff going on in terms of drugs and stuff, and you know, you could really bend your mind, and some people didn't come back, and I saw that happen to people I knew, and I didn't like that, but you know, it was part of the price, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And my, you know, a lot of my musical heroes sort of burned out really young. Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison, who I saw all of them, and they all, you know, burned out along with friends of mine who, as Dave said, never came back. I mean, I feel in a way grateful. I mean, it was really an amazing time to be, but I also feel like it could have been me that did not survive that. All that. I hitchhiked all over the place. I mean, who knows? I mean, so, and I knew people, you know.
It was a better climate, though. Somehow I think that hitchhiking then was better than it is
now.
There was more of a welcome thing and less of a feeling of vulnerability.
Yes.
And certainly not a lot of stories about
That's true.
Kind of stuff you hear about now, that it's just like, you know, kind of ghastly, you know,
right,
dismembering and all kinds of horrible stuff going on.
Yeah. there was more of a feeling of, wow, I can't believe how good people are, that you would mostly.
Yeah, it was,
but,
you know.
But I also had friends, you know, who went out to San Francisco and jumped off from buildings because they were high on LSD. I mean, you know,
And we got ripped off, too. You know, you didn't have much. It was close to the... You didn't have much. Probably all you had was in your pants pocket, and that wasn't a lot. Might buy you two meals. It was... We live in day by day, and, you know, sort of depending on others, in a sense. It was a shared thing.
And, Nancy, I mean, what are your thoughts in, based on your experiences?
Well, I think probably the drug scene was the scene that had the sharpest edges. I think that it liberated a lot of people in many ways. I consider LSD my spiritual teacher, my greatest spiritual teacher, but I didn't abuse it. I took it in very special places where I knew I would be safe and in circumstances that I could experience that kind of inner life in reality. I think that it was, you know, there was a certain recklessness that was permitted and encouraged because it was also new, and that people didn't really understand how potent these drugs were. And then there was, you know, like just dens of drug use where any kind of drug goes, and so it got that. I think unfortunately really tainted the whole culture in the eyes of the world. And on the other hand, it also united us in so many ways. You know, you walk into a place and somebody hands you a joint and you knew you were home, you know, that there was, you were safe and it was good and you were going to have conversations that you wanted to have with people. I wanted to say about when you asked about in Europe what was going on. Before I moved to New York, I went to Europe with a couple of friends in the summer of 67, and I was amazed. I mean, I was kind of naive. I really didn't know how widespread this was, and I became totally convinced of Jung's collective unconscious once I got to Europe, because we brought with us some tapes of Dylan and the Doors, Janis, and so we just found, like, we found European hippies. You said Amsterdam, Paris, London. London was incredible because of the Beatles, and so there was this incredible sense of unity. I never expected to find that over there. It was very, very exciting, and the music that we brought. We would find ourselves in these little basements with this, you know, small crowds of French or Dutch or British kids, and just, it was absolutely wonderful, that part. It was incredibly widespread. I don't know how it got so widespread, but it did.
Thank you. Once again, we're talking with Nancy Gallen on the phone, who was in Greenwich Village during the Summer of Love. Also in studio with us is Bonnie Blythe. She's the creator of the Portland Encyclopedia of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We've also got Dave Wade, who's an internationally renowned photographer and a jazz DJ here at WMPG. We'd like to remind you all that this is a call-in show. The number is 780-4909-780-4909 if you would like to ask a question or make a comment. I am Anthony Lewis.
Now I'm Iris Sangiovanni. Now, I'd like you know, would you consider, like, this summer to be, like, a pivotal time in your life as far as, you know, what you are doing now in your lives? I mean, like, Bonnie, for example, you're, you know, the Portland Encyclopedia of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I mean, would you have, you know, would you be doing this now, you think? I mean,
I don't know. That's kind of a fun project. And I don't know if I would be doing that, but in my professional life, I've worked for years with nonviolence issues, and I work with victims of domestic violence. So really, my professional life has really been devoted to nonviolent issues. I also worked with Maine Citizens Against Handgun Violence, and so I think that that did influence the paths that I chose and where I chose to put my professional energy. And then the Portland Encyclopedia is just, as Dave would say, a trip.
Where can we get this groovy document?
It's a Facebook.
Facebook, okay.
Page right now, sure. Yeah, just look it up on Facebook. We've got 5,500 and something members at this point. And so, yeah, join us.
And Nancy, I mean, you are, you know, still really politically involved. Has that, you know, have you continued to do so because of, you know, your experiences in Greenwich Village at the time?
I think it's more because of the kind of animal I am. I don't think, I think I was politically active then because of who I am. I don't think I think it gave me a channel for that and sort of gave me a way to funnel that energy. I think the biggest part of my life that came from those times, really, I mean, because one of the goals I always held close to my desires was to live my life as a political act and not have politics separate from how I lived, and in the same way, not to have to go to a job and have that, you know, support me, but to live my life as my job. So those things were in me, and then I became aware of the food movement, movement for healthier food, and because of the organic movement in California, it moved from west to east. And there I was in New York City where you could get, you know, food from all over the world. And I began to hear about organic food, read about it, and it made so much sense to me. I joined an organic food co-op that flew. The only way it was available, you couldn't buy it in stores. But through this co-op, we got organic food once a week that was flown in from California on an airplane, and we picked it up and distributed it. And I was completely convinced that this was the way to grow food because it tasted so much better, primarily. Mm-hmm. So as a result, long story short, I became an organic farmer for most of my adult life.
And so, Nancy, like, just to comment on what you said, like, that, you know, this was a part of your animal, and, like, that this was merely, you know, a place to be encouraged and to channel that energy. With that said, this is for everyone, but do you feel like this movement really just, brought out sort of this nature in people that were, you know, or... Sorry. Let me rephrase that. Like, why do you think, for those that weren't a part of this movement, you know, like, why didn't they get involved?
Why were some involved and others not?
Yes, that's where I was getting at. Thank you.
Okay, well, one thing that hasn't been mentioned in the time that I've been listening to the program yet is the Vietnam War. It may have been mentioned, but I tuned in late, so... but that war really galvanized people politically because of the draft. I really think the draft was a very unifying and galvanizing force in all of our lives at that time. And so opposing the war became the scaffolding, I guess you would call it, the structural background on which all other political movements seem to learn from, I guess you could say. It was a very creative resistance to the draft. There's a lot of creative things that were done. Everything from confronting police lines ways of getting out of the draft that were pretty funny. So so I think that that made it, that politicized us. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, because I've thought about what Nancy said too, about that this was sort of her nature, and even when I was like 13, I was always kind of a rebel at heart too, and by nature. I had older sisters who weren't necessarily part of that, even though they were more age appropriate probably for the movement, but I was kind of the rebel. So when I was 13, I was listening to Bob Dylan, Desolation Row, and Highway 61 Revisited was my favorite album. So I was fascinated by that stuff. So as a young teen, it just sort of gave me a vehicle to express that side of myself that I didn't find within around me really so much.
I think that's happens to a lot of people, and you know, we got caught up in it, and maybe it helped if you had a predisposition and were willing to think for yourself in a way, but there was also this earlier thing of turning in and dropping out, which created a lot of people who were not invested anymore in the normal society and were looking to form their own society. So there was a lot of new creative improvisation going on there.
So don't forget that marijuana came to us through the Vietnam War largely. I mean, it was on the streets, certainly in New York, and probably in Oakland and San Francisco, but for popular use, its availability, the soldiers brought it back to us.
I know how, Nancy, you mentioned that you said, this whole kind of culture, I know you mentioned that for you, LSD was what you called your spiritual advisor, and, you know, songs like this were clearly sort of meant to be listened to on a certain other level, and what was happening in London, and Bonnie, you were talking about how you hitchhiked, you were in New Hampshire, you hitchhiked up and down the coast. What did your parents and your family feel, how did they feel about this? I mean, you were rebelling, but what did they have any say in what you were doing, or did
right.
you just do it?
I didn't do that until like that was like 1970, after I graduated from high school that I did that, but I did go to Woodstock when I was 16, 17, that's in between in that year, and I was the youngest child, so by the time I came along, I think I had more freedom. My mother also, my dad died and my mother went back to college, so she was going to the University of New Hampshire in 1967-68, so she and I were kind of, my sisters were gone, but so she was surrounded by students involved in the movement, so she sort of was, she kind of understood where I was coming from, and I got a lot of freedom as a result.
She was groovy.
She was groovy. She was groovy definitely
mother.
Groovy. My groovy mother.
It's good to have a groovy mom.
Yeah.
I'd like to think my mom's pretty groovy. She's listening.
You remind me of also the whole thing about moving in together, couples, you know, just living together. And that was scandalous to parents. I know my parents were scandalized.
And there were also all over the country, there were flyers of missing kids, like runaway kids. Like, have you seen my daughter? Have you seen
That's
my
right.
son? They were everywhere.
That's right.
And so there were a lot of parents who were in big distress.
Yeah.
That's true.
Things changed, you know. I mean, the Summer of Love started off pretty good, but actually before the summer it was good, and then it started to go downhill rapidly.
Right.
And when the hard drugs started to show up and hit the street. And,
from Vietnam as well.
Yeah.
Right. And the whole police state that rose up from that.
That it got
so we don't want to end on a
downer. Well, no, that's okay.
No,
a bummer.
No.
Well, I'll always be grateful I was there for it. I can say that.
Well, this has been the Summer of Love show. We've been talking with Bonnie Blythe, Dave Wade, and Nancy Galland.
I thank you all, for your insight.
Thanks,
like,
guys.
I wasn't there, but I feel like, you know, part of me was.
Yeah.
Just from listening to your experiences. I'm Iris San Giovanni.
I am Anthony Lewis, and this has been Blunt Youth Radio on WMPG. And next up is jazz.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello? long night through. Well, you can cry me a river, cry me a river.